An account of the persecution of friends commonly called Quakers in the United States. About the middle of the 17th century, much persecution and suffering were inflicted on a sect of Protestant dissenters, commonly called Quakers, a people which arose at that time in England, some of whom sealed their testimony with their blood. For an account of the above people, see Sewall's or Gough's History of Them. The principal points upon which their conscientious nonconformity rendered them obnoxious to the penalties of the law were, 1. The Christian resolution of assembling publicly for the worship of God in a manner most agreeable to their consciences. 2. Their refusal to pay tithes, which they esteemed a Jewish ceremony, abrogated by the coming of Christ. Their testimony against wars and fighting, the practice of which they judged inconsistent with the command of Christ, "Love your enemies," Matthew chapter 5, verse 44. 4. Their constant obedience to the command of Christ, "Swear not at all," Matthew chapter 5, verse 34. 5. Their refusal to pay rates or assessments for building and repairing houses for a worship which they did not approve. 6. Their use of the proper and scriptural language "thou and thee" to a single person, and their disuse of the custom of uncovering their heads or pulling off their hats by way of homage to man. And 7. The necessity many found themselves under of publishing what they believed to be the doctrine of truth, and sometimes even in the places appointed for the public national worship. Their conscientious non-compliance in the preceding particulars exposed them to much persecution and suffering, which consisted in prosecutions, fines, cruel beatings, whippings, and other corporal punishments, imprisonment, banishment, and even death. To relate a particular account of their persecutions and sufferings would extend beyond the limits of this work. We shall therefore refer for that information to the histories already mentioned, and more particularly to Bess's collection of their sufferings, and shall confine our account here mostly to those who sacrificed their lives, and evinced by their disposition of mind, constancy, patience, and faithful perseverance, that they were influenced by a sense of religious duty. Numerous and repeated were the persecutions against them, and sometimes for transgressions or offences which the law did not contemplate or embrace. Many of the fines and penalties exacted of them were not only unreasonable and exorbitant, but as they could not consistently pay them, were sometimes distrained to several times the value of the demand, whereby many poor families were greatly distressed and obliged to depend on the assistance of their friends. Numbers were not only cruelly beaten and whipped in a public manner like criminals, but some were branded and others had their ears cut off. Great numbers were long confined in loathsome prisons, in which some ended their days in consequence thereof. Many were sentenced to banishment, and a considerable number were transported. Some were banished on pain of death, and 4 were actually executed by the hands of the hangman, as we shall here relate, after inserting copies of some of the laws of the country where they suffered. This is a quote from a general court held at Boston the 14th of October, 1656. "Whereas there is a cursed sect of heretics, lately risen up in the world, which are commonly called Quakers, who take upon them to be immediately sent from God, and infallibly assisted by the Spirit, to speak and write blasphemous opinions, despising government and the order of God in the church and commonwealth, speaking evil of dignities, reproaching and reviling magistrates and ministers, seeking to turn the people from the faith and gain proselytes to their pernicious ways. This court, taking into consideration the premises, and to prevent the like mischief as by their means is wrought in our land, doth hereby order and by authority of this court be it ordered and enacted, that what master or commander of any ship, bark, pink, or ketch, shall henceforth bring into any harbour, creek, or cove within this jurisdiction any Quaker or Quakers or other blasphemous heretics, shall pay or cause to be paid the fine of £100 to the treasurer of the country, except it appear he want true knowledge or information of their being such. And in that case, he hath liberty to clear himself by his oath, when sufficient proof to the contrary is wanting. And for default of good payment, or good security for it, shall be cast into prison, and there to continue until the said sum be satisfied to the treasurer as foresaid. And the commander of any ketch, ship, or vessel being legally convicted, shall give insufficient security to the governor, or any one or more of the magistrates who have power to determine the same, to carry them back to the place whence he brought them, and on his refusal to do so, the governor or one or more of the magistrates are hereby empowered to issue out his or their warrants to commit such master or commander to prison, there to continue until he give insufficient security to the content of the governor or any of the magistrates as aforesaid. And it is hereby further ordered and enacted that what Quaker soever shall arrive in this country from foreign parts, or shall come into this jurisdiction from any parts adjacent, shall be forthwith committed to the House of Correction, and at their entrance to be severely whipped, and by the master thereof be kept constantly to work, and none suffered to converse or speak with them during the time of their imprisonment, which shall be no longer than necessity requires. And it is ordered, if any person shall knowingly import into any harbour of this jurisdiction any Quaker's books or writings concerning their devilish opinions, shall pay for such book or writing, being legally proved against him or them, the sum of £5, and whosoever shall disperse or conceal any such book or writing, and it be found with him or her, or in his or her house, and shall not immediately deliver the same to the next magistrate, shall forfeit or pay £5 for the dispersing or concealing of any such book or writing. And it is hereby further enacted, that if any persons within this colony shall take upon them to defend the heretical opinions of the Quakers, or any of their books or papers, shall be fined for the first time 40 shillings. If they shall persist in the same, and shall again defend it the second time, £4. If notwithstanding they again defend and maintain the said Quakers' heretical opinions, they shall be committed to the House of Correction until there be convenient passage to send them out of the land, being sentenced by the Court of Assistance to banishment. Lastly, it is hereby ordered that what person or persons soever shall revile the persons of the magistrates or ministers, as is usual with the Quakers, such person or person shall be severely whipped or pay the sum of £5. This is a true copy of the court's order, as attests Edward Rawson, Secretary. The following quotation is from a general court held at Boston the 14th of October, 1657. As an addition to the late order in reference to the coming or bringing of any of the cursed sect of the Quakers into this jurisdiction, it is ordered that whosoever shall from henceforth bring or cause to be brought directly or indirectly any known Quaker or Quakers or other blasphemous heretics into this jurisdiction, every such person shall forfeit the sum of £100 to the country, and shall by warrant from any magistrate be committed to prison, there to remain until the penalty be satisfied and paid. And if any person or persons within this jurisdiction shall henceforth entertain and conceal any such Quaker or Quakers, or other blasphemous heretics, knowing them so to be, every such person shall forfeit to the country 40 shillings for every hour's entertainment and concealment of any Quaker or Quaker, etc., as aforesaid, and shall be committed to prison as aforesaid until the forfeiture be fully satisfied and paid. And it is further ordered that if any Quaker or Quaker shall presume, after they have once suffered what the law requires, to come into this jurisdiction, every such male Quaker shall, for the first offence, have one of his ears cut off, and be kept at work in the House of Correction until he can be sent away at his own charge, and for the second offence shall have his other ear cut off. And every woman Quaker that has suffered the law here, that shall presume to come into this jurisdiction, shall be severely whipped, and kept at the House of Corrections at work until she be sent away at her own charge, and so also for her coming again she shall be alike used as aforesaid. And for every Quaker, he or she that shall a third time herein again offend, they shall have their tongues bored through with a hot iron, and be kept at the House of Correction close to work until they be sent away at their own charge. And it is further ordered that all and every Quaker arising from among ourselves shall be dealt with and suffer the like punishment as the law provides against foreign Quakers. Edward Rawson, Secretary. The final quotation is from an act made at a general court held at Boston the 20th of October, 1658. Whereas there is a pernicious sect commonly called Quakers, lately risen, who by word and writing have published and maintained many dangerous and horrid tenets, and do take upon them to change and alter the received laudable customs of our nation, in giving civil respect to equals or reverence to superiors, whose actions tend to undermine the civil government and also to destroy the order of the churches by denying all established forms of worship and by withdrawing from orderly church fellowship allowed and approved by all orthodox professors of truth, and instead thereof, and in opposition thereunto, frequently meeting by themselves, insinuating themselves into the minds of the simple, or such as are at least affected to the order and government of church and commonwealth, whereby divers of our inhabitants have been infected, notwithstanding all former laws, made upon the experience of their arrogant and bold obtrusions, to disseminate their principles amongst us, prohibiting their coming into this jurisdiction. They have not been deferred from their impious attempts to undermine our peace and hazard our ruin. For prevention thereof, this court doth order and enact that any person or persons of the cursed sect of the Quakers, who is not an inhabitant of, but is found within this jurisdiction, shall be apprehended without warrant, where no magistrate is at hand, by any constable, commissioner, or select man, and conveyed from constable to constable to the next magistrate, who shall commit the said person to close prison, there to remain without bail until the next court of assistance, where they shall have legal trial. And being convicted to be of the sect of the Quakers, shall be sentenced to banishment on pain of death, and that every inhabitant of this jurisdiction, being convicted to be of the aforesaid sect, either by taking up, publishing, or defending the horrid opinions of the Quakers, or the stirring up mutiny, sedition, or rebellion against the government, or by taking up their abusive and destructive practices, namely denying civil respect to equals and superiors, and withdrawing from the church assemblies, and instead thereof frequenting meetings of their own in opposition to our church order, adhering to or approving of any known Quaker and the tenets and practice of Quakers that are opposite to the orthodox received opinions of the godly, and endeavouring to disaffect others to civil government and church order, or condemning the practice and proceedings of this court against the Quakers, manifesting thereby their complying with those whose design is to overthrow the order established in church and state, every such person, upon conviction before the said court of assistance, in manner aforesaid, shall be committed to close prison for 1 month. And then, unless they choose voluntarily to depart this jurisdiction, shall give bond for their good behaviour and appear at the next court. Continuing obstinate and refusing to retract and reform the aforesaid opinions, they shall be sentenced to banishment upon pain of death. And any one magistrate, upon information given him of any such person, shall cause him to be apprehended, and shall commit any such person to prison, according to his discretion, until he come to trial, as aforesaid. It appears there were also laws passed in both of the then colonies of New Plymouth and New Haven, and in the Dutch settlement at New Amsterdam, now New York, prohibiting the people called Quakers from coming into those places under severe penalties, in consequence of which some underwent considerable suffering. The two first who were executed were William Robinson, merchant of London, and Marmaduke Stevenson, a countryman of Yorkshire. These, coming to Boston in the beginning of September, were sent for by the Court of Assistance, and there sentenced to banishment on pain of death. This sentence was passed also on Mary Dyer, mentioned hereafter, and Nicholas Davis, who were both at Boston. But William Robinson, being looked upon as a teacher, was also condemned to be whipped severely, and the constable was commanded to get an able man to do it. Then Robinson was brought into the street and there stripped, and having his hands put through the holes of the carriage of a great gun, where the jailer held him, the executioner gave him 20 stripes with a 3-fold cord whip. Then he and the other prisoners were shortly after released and banished, as appears from the following warrant. You are required by these presently to set at liberty William Robinson, Marmaduke Stevenson, Mary Dyer, and Nicholas Davis, who by an order of the court and council had been imprisoned, because it appeared by their own confession, words, and actions that they are Quakers, wherefore a sentence was pronounced against them to depart this jurisdiction on pain of death, and that they must answer it at their peril if they or any of them after the 14th of this present month, September, are found within this jurisdiction or any part thereof. Edward Rawson, Boston, September 12, 1659. Though Mary Dyer and Nicholas Davis left that jurisdiction for that time, Yet Robinson and Stevenson, though they departed the town of Boston, could not yet resolve, not being free in mind, to depart that jurisdiction, though their lives were at stake. And so they went to Salem and some places thereabouts to visit and build up their friends in the faith. But it was not long before they were taken and put again into prison at Boston, and chains locked to their legs. In the next month Mary Dyer returned also, and as she stood before the prison speaking with one Christopher Holden, who has come thither to inquire for a ship bound for England, whither he intended to go, she was also taken into custody. Thus they had now three persons who, according to the law, had forfeited their lives. And on the 20th of October these three were brought into court, where John Endicott and others were assembled. And being called to the bar, Endicott commanded the keeper to pull off their hats, and then said that they had made several laws to keep the Quakers from amongst them, and neither whipping nor imprisoning nor cutting off ears nor banishment upon pain of death would keep them from amongst them. And further he said that he or they desired not the death of any of them. Yet notwithstanding, his following words without more ado were, "Give ear and hearken to your sentence of death." Sentence of death was also passed upon Marmaduke Stevenson, Mary Dyer, and William Edred. Several others were imprisoned, whipped, and fined. We have no disposition to justify the Pilgrims for these proceedings, but we think, considering the circumstances of the age in which they lived, their conduct admits of much palliation. The fathers of New England endured incredible hardships in providing for themselves a home in the wilderness, and to protect themselves in the undisturbed enjoyment of rights which they had purchased at so dear a rate. They sometimes adopted measures which, if tried by the more enlightened and liberal views of the present day, must at once be pronounced altogether unjustifiable. But shall they be condemned without mercy for not acting up to principles which were unacknowledged and unknown throughout the whole of Christendom? Shall they alone be held responsible for opinions and conduct which had become sacred by antiquity and which were common to Christians of all other denominations? Every government then in existence assumed to itself the right to legislate in matters of religion and to restrain heresy by penal statutes. This right was claimed by rulers, admitted by subjects, and is sanctioned by the names of Lord Bacon and Montesquieu and many others equally famed for their talents and learning. It is unjust, then, to press upon one poor persecuted sect the sins of all Christendom. The fault of our fathers was the fault of the age, and though this cannot justify, it certainly furnishes an extenuation of their conduct. As well might you condemn them for not understanding and acting up to the principles of religious toleration. At the same time, it is but just to say that imperfect as were their views of the rights of conscience, they were nevertheless far in advance of the age to which they belonged, and it is to them, more than to any other class of men on earth, the world is indebted for the more rational views that now prevail on the subject of civil and religious liberty. Chapter 19. An Account of the Life and Persecutions of John Bunyan. This great Puritan was born the same year that the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth. His home was Elstow, near Bedford, in England. His father was a tinker, and he was brought up to the same trade. He was a lively, likeable boy with a serious and almost morbid side to his nature. All during his young manhood, he was repenting for the vices of his youth, and yet he had never been either a drunkard or immoral. The particular acts that troubled his conscience were dancing, ringing the church bells, and playing cat. It was while playing the latter game one day that a voice did suddenly dart from heaven into my soul, which said, "Wilt thou leave thy sins and go to heaven, or have thy sins and go to hell?" At about this time he overheard three or four poor women in Bedford talking as they sat at the door in the sun. Their talk was about the new birth, the work of God in the hearts. They were far above my reach. In his youth he was a member of the Parliamentary Army for a year. The death of his comrade, close beside him, deepened his tendency to serious thoughts, and there were times when he seemed almost insane in his zeal and penitence. He was at one time quite assured that he had sinned the unpardonable sin against the Holy Ghost. While he was still a young man, he married a good woman who bought him a library of pious books, which he read with assiduity, thus confirming his earnestness and increasing his love of religious controversies. His conscience was still further awakened through the persecution of the religious body of Baptists to whom he had joined himself. Before he was 30 years old, he had become a leading Baptist preacher. Then came his turn for persecution. He was arrested for preaching without license. "Before I went down to the justice, I begged of God that his will be done, for I was not without hopes that my imprisonment might be an awakening to the saints in the country. Only in that matter did I commit the thing to God, and verily at my return I did meet my God sweetly in the prison." His hardships were genuine on account of the wretched condition of the prisons of those days. To this confinement was added the personal grief of being parted from his young and second wife and four small children, and particularly his little blind daughter. While he was in jail, he was solaced by the two books which he had brought with him, the Bible and Fox's Book of Martyrs. Although he wrote some of his early books during this long imprisonment, it was not until his second and shorter one, 3 years after the first, that he composed his immortal Pilgrim's Progress, which was published 3 years later. In an earlier tract, he had thought briefly of the similarity between human life and a pilgrimage, and he now worked this theme out in fascinating detail, using the rural scenery of England for his background, the splendid city of London for his Vanity Fair, and the saints and villains of his own personal acquaintance for the finely drawn characters of his allegory. The Pilgrim's Progress is truly the rehearsal of Bunyan's own spiritual experiences. He himself had been the man clothed in rags, with his face from his own house, a book in his hand and a great burden upon his back. After he had realized that Christ was his righteousness, and that this did not depend on the good frame of his heart, or, as we should say, on his feelings, "now did the chains fall off my legs indeed." His had been doubting Castellan's sloughs of despond, with much of the valley of humiliation and the shadow of death. But above all, it is a book of victory. Once when he was leaving the doors of the courthouse, where he himself had been defeated, he wrote, "As I was going forth of the doors, I had much ado to bear saying to them that I carried the peace of God along with me." In his vision was ever the celestial city, with all its bells ringing. He had fought Apollyon constantly, and often been wounded, shamed, and fallen, yet in the end more than conqueror through him that loved us. His book was at first received with much criticism from his Puritan friends, who saw in it only an addition to the worldly literature of his day. But there was not much then for Puritans to read, and it was not long before it was devoutly laid beside their Bibles and perused with gladness and with profit. It was perhaps 2 centuries later before literary critics began to realize that this story, so full of human reality and interest, and so marvellously modelled upon the English of the King James translation of the Bible, is one of the glories of English literature. In his later years he wrote several other allegories, of which one of them, the Holy War, it has been said that if the Pilgrim's Progress had never been written, it would be regarded as the finest allegory in the language. During the later years of his life, Bunyan remained in Bedford as a venerated local pastor and preacher. He was also a favourite speaker in the nonconformist pulpits of London. He became so national a leader and teacher that he was frequently called Bishop Bunyan. In his helpful and unselfish personal life, he was apostolic. His last illness was due to exposure upon a journey in which he was endeavouring to reconcile a father with his son. His end came on the 3rd of August, 1688. He was buried in Bunhill Fields, a churchyard in London. There is no doubt but that The Pilgrim's Progress has been more helpful than any other book but the Bible. It was timely, for there were still burning martyrs in Vanity Fair while he was writing. It is enduring, for while it tells little of living the Christian life in the family and community, it does interpret that life so far as it is an expression of the solitary soul in homely language. Bunyan, indeed, showed how to build a princely throne on humble truth. He has been his own great heart, dauntless guide to pilgrims, to many. Chapter 20. An Account of the Life of John Wesley. John Wesley was born on the 17th of June, 1703, in Epworth Rectory, England, the 15th of 19 children of Charles and Susanna Wesley. The father of Wesley was a preacher, and Wesley's mother was a remarkable woman in wisdom and intelligence. She was a woman of deep piety and brought her little ones into close contact with the Bible stories, telling them from the tiles about the nursery fireplace. She also used to dress the children in their best on the days when they were to have the privilege of learning their alphabet as an introduction to the reading of the Holy Scriptures. Young Wesley was a gay and manly youth, fond of games and particularly of dancing. At Oxford, he was a leader, and during the latter part of his course there, was one of the founders of the Holy Club, an organization of serious-minded students. His religious nature deepened through study and experience, but it was not until several years after he left the university and came under the influence of Luther's writings that he felt that he had entered into the full riches of the gospel. He and his brother Charles were sent by the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel to Georgia, where both of them developed their powers as preachers. Upon their passage, they fell into the company of several Moravian brethren, members of the association recently renewed by the labours of Count Zinzendorf. It was noted by John Wesley in his diary that in a great tempest, when the English people on board lost all self-possession, these Germans impressed him by their composure and entire resignation to God. He also marked their humility under shameful treatment. It was on his return to England that he entered into those deeper experiences and developed those marvellous powers as a popular preacher, which made him a national leader. He was associated at this time also with George Whitefield, the tradition of whose marvellous eloquence has never died. What he accomplished borders upon the incredible. Upon entering his 85th year, he thanked God that he was still almost as vigorous as ever. He ascribed it, under God, to the fact that he had always slept soundly, had risen for 60 years at 4 o'clock in the morning, and for 50 years had preached every morning at 5. Seldom in all his life did he feel any pain, care, or anxiety. He preached twice each day, and often thrice or four times. It has been estimated that he travelled every year 4,500 English miles, mostly upon horseback. The successes won by Methodist preaching had to be gained through a long series of years and amid the most bitter persecutions. In nearly every part of England, it was met at the first by the mob with stonings and peltings, with attempts at wounding and slaying. Only at times was there any interference on the part of the civil power. The two Wesleys faced all these dangers with amazing courage and with a calmness equally astonishing. What was more irritating was the heaping up of slander and abuse by the writers of the day. These books are now all forgotten. Wesley had been in his youth a high churchman and was always deeply devoted to the established communion. When he found it necessary to ordain preachers, the separation of his followers from the established body became inevitable. The name Methodist soon attached to them because of the particular organizing power of their leader and the ingenious methods that he applied. The Wesley Fellowship, which after his death grew into the great Methodist Church, was characterized by an almost military perfection of organization. The entire management of his ever-growing denomination rested upon Wesley himself. The annual conference, established in 1744, acquired a governing power only after the death of Wesley. Charles Wesley rendered the society a service incalculably great by his hymns. They introduced a new era in hymnology of the English Church. John Wesley apportioned his days to his work in leading the church, to studying, for he was an incessant reader, to travelling and to preaching. Wesley was untiring in his efforts to disseminate useful knowledge throughout his denomination. He planned for the mental culture of his travelling preachers and local exhorters, and for schools of instruction for the future teachers of the church. He himself prepared books for popular use upon universal history, church history, and natural history. In this, Wesley was an apostle of the modern union of mental culture with Christian living. He published also the best matured of his sermons and various theological works. These, both by their depth and their penetration of thought, and by their purity and precision of style, excite our admiration. John Wesley was of but ordinary stature, and yet of noble presence. His features were very handsome, even in old age. He had an open brow, an eagle nose, a clear eye, and a fresh complexion. His manners were fine, and in choice company with Christian people, he enjoyed relaxation. persistent, laborious love for men's souls, steadfastness and tranquility of spirit were his most prominent traits of character. Even in doctrinal controversies, he exhibited the greatest calmness. He was kind and very liberal. His industry has been named already. In the last 52 years of his life, it is estimated that he preached more than 40,000 sermons. Wesley brought sinners to repentance throughout three kingdoms and over two hemispheres. He was the bishop of such a diocese as neither the Eastern nor the Western Church ever witnessed before. What is there in the circle of Christian effort, foreign missions, home missions, Christian tracts and literature, field preaching, circuit preaching, Bible readings or aught else, which was not attempted by John Wesley, which was not grasped by his mighty mind through the aid of his divine leader? To him it was granted to arouse the English Church, when it had lost sight of Christ the Redeemer, to a renewed Christian life. By preaching the justifying and renewing of the soul through belief upon Christ, he lifted many thousands of the humbler classes of the English people from their exceeding ignorance and evil habits, and made them earnest, faithful Christians. His untiring effort made itself felt not in England alone, but in America and in continental Europe. Not only the germs of almost all the existing zeal in England on behalf of Christian truth and life are due to Methodism, but the activity stirred up in other portions of Protestant Europe, we must trace, indirectly at least, to Wesley. He died in 1791, after a long life of tireless labour and unselfish service. His fervent spirit and hearty brotherhood still survives in the body that cherishes his name. Chapter 21. Persecutions of the French Protestants in the south of France during the years 1814 and 1820. The persecution in this Protestant part of France continued with very little intermission from the revocation of the Edict of Nantes by Louis XIV until a very short period previous to the commencement of the late French Revolution. In the year 1785, Monsieur Rebaud Saint-Étienne and the celebrated Monsieur de Lafayette were among the first persons who interested themselves with the court of Louis XVI in removing the scourge of persecution from this injured people, the inhabitants of the south of France. Such was the opposition on the part of the Catholics and the courtiers that it was not until the end of the year 1790 that the Protestants were freed from their alarms. Previous to this, the Catholics at Nîmes in particular had taken up arms. Nîmes then presented a frightful spectacle. Armed men ran through the city, fired from the corners of the streets, and attacked all they met with swords and forks. A man named Astouc was wounded and thrown into the aqueduct. Baudin fell under the repeated strokes of bayonets and sabres, and his body was also thrown into the water. Boucher, a young man only 17 years of age, was shot as he was looking out of his window. Three electors wounded, one dangerously. Another elector wounded only escaped death by repeatedly declaring he was a Catholic. A third received four sabre wounds and was taken home dreadfully mangled. The citizens that fled were arrested by the Catholics upon the roads and obliged to give proofs of their religion before their lives were granted. Monsieur and Madame Vogue were at their country house, which the zealots broke open, where they massacred both and destroyed their dwelling. Monsieur Blachet, a Protestant 70 years of age, was cut to pieces with a sickle. Young Pierre, carrying some food to his brother, was asked, "Catholic or Protestant?" "Protestant," being the reply. A monster fired at the lad and he fell. One of the murderer's companions said he might as well have killed a lamb. "I have sworn," replied he, "to kill four Protestants for my share, and this will count for one." However, as these atrocities provoked the troops to unite in defence of the people, a terrible vengeance was retaliated upon the Catholic party that had used arms, which, with other circumstances, especially the toleration exercised by Napoleon Bonaparte, kept them down completely until the year 1814, when the unexpected return of the ancient government rallied them all once more round the old banners. The arrival of King Louis XVIII at Paris. This was known at Nîmes on the 13th of April 1814. In a quarter of an hour, the white cockade was seen in every direction. The white flag floated on the public buildings, on the splendid monuments of antiquity, and even on the Tower of Mange beyond the city walls. The Protestants, whose commerce had suffered materially during the war, were among the first to unite in the general joy and to send in their adhesion to the Senate and the legislative body, and several of the Protestant departments sent addresses to the throne. But unfortunately, Monsieur Froment was again at Nîmes, at the moment when many bigots, being ready to join him, the blindness and fury of the 16th century rapidly succeeded the intelligence and philanthropy of the 19th. A line of distinction was instantly traced between men of different religious opinions. The spirit of the old Catholic Church was again to regulate each person's share of esteem and safety. The difference of religion was now to govern everything else, and even Catholic domestics who had served Protestants with zeal and affection began to neglect their duties or to perform them ungraciously and with reluctance. At the fêtes and spectacles that were given at the public expense, the absence of the Protestants was charged on them as a proof of their disloyalty, and in the midst of the cries of Vive le Roi, the discordant sounds of A bas le maire, down with the maire, were heard. Monsieur Castelton was a Protestant. He appeared in public with the prefect, Monsieur Roulant, a Catholic, when potatoes were thrown at him, and the people declared that he ought to resign his office. The bigots of Nîmes even succeeded in procuring an address to be presented to the king, stating that there ought to be in France but one God, one king, and one faith. In this they were imitated by the Catholics of several towns. The History of the Silver Child. About this time, Monsieur Baron, councillor of the Cour Royale of Nîmes, formed the plan of dedicating to God a silver child if the Duchesse d'Angoulême would give a prince to France. This project was converted into a public religious vow, which was the subject of conversation both in public and private. Whilst persons whose imaginations were inflamed by these proceedings ran about the streets crying, Vive les Bourbons, or the Bourbons forever. In consequence of this superstitious frenzy, it is said that at Alais women were advised and instigated to poison their Protestant husbands, and at length it was found convenient to accuse them of political crimes. They could no longer appear in public without insults and injuries. When the mobs met with Protestants, they seized them and danced round them with barbarous joy, and amidst repeated cries of Vive le Roi, they sang verses, the burden of which was, We will wash our hands in Protestant blood and make black puddings of the blood of Calvin's children. The citizens, who came to the promenade for air and refreshment from the close and dirty streets, were chased with shouts of Vive le Roi, as if those shouts were to justify every excess. If Protestants referred to the Charter, they were directly assured it would be of no use to them, and that they'd only been managed to be more effectually destroyed. Persons of rank were heard to say in the public streets, All the Huguenots must be killed, this time their children must be killed, that none of the accursed race may remain. Still, it is true they were not murdered, but cruelly treated. Protestant children could no longer mix in the sports of Catholics, and were not even permitted to appear without their parents. At dark, their families shut themselves up in their apartments, but even then stones were thrown against their windows. When they arose in the morning, it was not uncommon to find gibbets drawn on their doors or walls, and in the streets the Catholics held cords already soaped before their eyes and pointed out the instruments by which they hoped and designed to exterminate them. Small gallows or models were handed about, and a man who lived opposite to one of the pastors exhibited one of these models in his window and made signs sufficiently intelligible when the minister passed. A figure representing a Protestant preacher was also hung up on a public crossway, and the most atrocious songs were sung under his window. Towards the conclusion of the carnival, a plan had even been formed to make a caricature of the four ministers of the place and burn them in effigy. But this was prevented by the mayor of Nîmes, a Protestant. A dreadful song presented to the prefect in the country dialect with a false translation was printed by his approval and had a great run before he saw the extent of the error into which he had been betrayed. The 63rd Regiment of the Line was publicly censured and insulted for having, according to order, protected Protestants. In fact, the Protestants seemed to be as sheep destined for the slaughter. The Catholic arms at Beaucaire. In May 1815, a federative association similar to that of Lyon, Grenoble, Paris, Avignon and Montpellier was desired by many persons at Nîmes. But this federation terminated here after an ephemeral and illusory existence of 14 days. In the meanwhile, a large party of Catholic zealots were in arms at Beaucaire, who soon pushed their patrols so near the walls of Nîmes so as to alarm the inhabitants. These Catholics applied to the English off Marseille for assistance and obtained the grant of 1,000 muskets, 10,000 cartouches, etc. General Gilly, however, was soon sent against these partisans, who prevented them from coming to extremes by granting them an armistice. And yet, when Louis XVIII had returned to Paris after the expiration of Napoleon's reign of 100 days, and peace and party spirit seemed to have been subdued even at Nîmes, bands from Beaucaire joined Trestaillon in the city to glut the vengeance they had so long premeditated. General Gilly had left the department several days. The troops of the line left behind had taken the white cockade and waited further orders, whilst the new commissioners had only to proclaim the cessation of hostilities and the complete establishment of the king's authority. In vain. No commissioners appeared, no dispatches arrived to calm and regulate the public mind. But towards evening, the advanced guard of the banditti, to the amount of several hundreds, entered the city, undesired but unopposed. As they marched without order or discipline, covered with clothes or rags of all colours, decorated with cockades not white but white and green, armed with muskets, sabres, forks, pistols and reaping hooks, intoxicated with wine and stained with the blood of the Protestants they had murdered on their route, they presented a most hideous and appalling spectacle. In the open place in front of the barracks, these banditti were joined by the city armed mob headed by Jacques Dupont, commonly called Trestaillon. To save the effusion of blood, this garrison of about 500 men consented to capitulate and marched out, sad and defenceless. But when about 50 had passed, the rabble commenced a tremendous fire on their confiding and unprotected victims. Nearly all were killed or wounded, and but very few could re-enter the yard before the garrison gates were again closed. These were again forced in an instant, and all were massacred who would not climb over roofs or leap into the adjoining gardens. In a word, death met them in every place and in every shape, and this Catholic massacre rivaled in cruelty and surpassed in treachery the crimes of the September assassins of Paris and the Jacobinical butcheries of Lyon and Avignon. It was marked not only by the fervour of the revolution, but by the subtlety of the League, and will long remain a blot upon the history of the Second Restoration. Massacre and pillage at Nîmes. Nîmes now exhibited a most awful scene of outrage and carnage, though many of the Protestants had fled to the Convent and the Gardonanque. The country houses of Messrs. Ray, Guiret, and several others had been pillaged and the inhabitants treated with wanton barbarity. Two parties had glutted their savage appetites on the farm of Madame Fra. The first, after eating, drinking, and breaking the furniture, and stealing what they thought proper, took leave by announcing the arrival of their comrades, compared with whom, they said, they should be thought merciful. Three men and an old woman were left on the premises. At the sight of the second company, two of the men fled. "Are you a Catholic?" said the banditti to the old woman. "Yes. Repeat then your Pater and Ave." Being terrified, she hesitated and was instantly knocked down with a musket. On recovering her senses, she stole out of the house, but met Ladet, the old valet de ferme, bringing in a salad, which the depredators had ordered him to cut. In vain she endeavoured to persuade him to fly. "Are you a Protestant?" they exclaimed. "I am." A musket being discharged at him, he fell wounded but not dead. To consummate their work, the monsters lighted a fire with straw and boards, threw their living victim into the flames, and suffered him to expire in the most dreadful agonies. They then ate their salad, omelette, etc. The next day, some labourers, seeing the house open and deserted, entered and discovered the half-consumed body of Ladet. The prefect of the guard, Monsieur Darbeau-Jouque, attempting to palliate the crimes of the Catholics, had the audacity to assert that Lade was a Catholic, but this was publicly contradicted by two of the pastors at Nîmes. Another party committed a dreadful murder at Saint-Césaire upon Humbert Laplume, the husband of Susan Chivat. He was met on returning from work in the fields. The chief promised him his life, but insisted that he must be conducted to the prison at Nîmes. Seeing, however, that the party was determined to kill him, he resumed his natural character, and being a powerful and courageous man, advanced and exclaimed, "You are brigands! Fire!" Four of them fired, and he fell. But he was not dead, and while living they mutilated his body, and then passing a cord round it, drew it along, attached to a cannon of which they had possession. It was not until after 8 days that his relatives were apprised of his death. Five individuals of the family of Shiva, all husbands and fathers, were massacred in the course of a few days. The merciless treatment of the women in this persecution at Nîmes was such as would have disgraced any savages ever heard of. The widows Rivet and Bernard were forced to sacrifice enormous sums, and the house of Madame Lecointe was ravaged and her goods destroyed. Madame F. Didier had her dwelling sacked and nearly demolished to the foundation. A party of these bigots visited the widow Perrin, who lived on a little farm at the windmills. Having committed every species of devastation, they attacked even the sanctuary of the dead, which contained the relics of her family. They dragged the coffins out and scattered the contents over the adjacent grounds. In vain this outraged widow collected the bones of her ancestors and replaced them. They were again dug up, and after several useless efforts they were reluctantly left, spread over the surface of the fields. Royal decree in favour of the persecuted. At length the decree of Louis XVIII, which annulled all the extraordinary powers conferred either by the king, the princes, or subordinate agents, was received at Nîmes, and the laws were now to be administered by the regular organs, and a new prefect arrived to carry them into effect. But in spite of proclamations, the work of destruction, stopped for a moment, was not abandoned, but soon renewed with fresh vigour and effect. On the 30th of July, Jacques Combes, the father of a family, was killed by some of the National Guards of Rousseau. And the crime was so public that the commander of the party restored to the family the pocketbook and papers of the deceased. On the following day, tumultuous crowds roamed about the city and suburbs, threatening the wretched peasants, and on the 1st of August they butchered them without opposition. About noon on the same day, six armed men, headed by Truffemy, the butcher, surrounded the house of Monod, a carpenter. Two of the party, who were smiths, had been at work in the house the day before, and had seen a Protestant who had taken refuge there, Monsieur Bourillon, who had been a lieutenant in the army and had retired on a pension. He was a man of an excellent character, peaceable and harmless, and had never served the Emperor Napoleon. Truffemy, not knowing him, he was pointed out partaking of a frugal breakfast with the family. Truffemy ordered him to go along with him, adding, "Your friend Saucine is already in the other world." Truffemy placed him in the middle of his troop and artfully ordered him to cry, "Vive l'Empereur!" He refused, adding he had never served the Emperor. In vain did the women and children of the house intercede for his life and praise his amiable and virtuous qualities. He was marched to the Esplanade and shot, first by Truffemy and then by the others. Several persons attracted by the firing approached, but were threatened with a similar fate. After some time the wretches departed, shouting "Vive le roi!" Some women met them, and one of them, appearing affected, said, "I've killed seven today for my share, and if you say a word, you shall be the eighth." Pierre Courbet, a stocking weaver, was torn from his loom by an armed band and shot at his own door. His eldest daughter was knocked down with the butt end of a musket, and a poignard was held at the breast of his wife while the mob plundered her apartments. Paul Hérault, a silk weaver, was literally cut in pieces in the presence of a large crowd, and amidst the unavailing cries and tears of his wife and four young children. The murderers only abandoned the corpse to return to Hérault's house and secure everything valuable. The number of murders on this day could not be ascertained. One person saw six bodies at the Cour Neuf, and nine were carried to the hospital. If murder sometime after became less frequent for a few days, pillage and forced contributions were actively enforced. Monsieur Salle d'Ambreux, at several visits, was robbed of 7,000 francs, and on one occasion, when he pleaded the sacrifices he had made, "Look," said a bandit, pointing to his pipe, "this will set fire to your house, and this," brandishing his sword, "will finish you." No reply could be made to these arguments. Monsieur Féline, a silk manufacturer, was robbed of 32,000 francs in gold, 3,000 francs in silver, and several bales of silk. The small shopkeepers were continually exposed to visits and demands of provisions, drapery, or whatever they sold, and the same hands that set fire to the houses of the rich and tore up the vines of the cultivator broke the looms of the weaver and stole the tools of the artisan. Desolation reigned in the sanctuary and in the city. The armed bands, instead of being reduced, were increased. The fugitives, instead of returning, received constant accessions, and their friends who sheltered them were deemed rebellious. Those Protestants who remained were deprived of all their civil and religious rights, and even the advocates and huissiers entered into a resolution to exclude all of the pretended reformed religion from their bodies. Those who were employed in selling tobacco were deprived of their licenses. The Protestant deacons, who had the charge of the poor, were all scattered. Of five pastors, only two remained. One of these was obliged to change his residence and could only venture to administer the consolations of religion or perform the functions of his ministry under cover of the night. Not content with these modes of torment, calumnious and inflammatory publications charged the Protestants with raising the proscribed standard in the communes and invoking the fallen Napoleon, and of course, as unworthy the protection of the laws and the favour of the monarch. Hundreds after this were dragged to prison without even so much as a written order, and though an official newspaper bearing the title of the Journal du Gard was set up for 5 months, while it was influenced by the prefect, the mayor and other functionaries, the word charter was never once used in it. One of the first numbers, on the contrary, represented the suffering Protestants as crocodiles only weeping from rage and regret that they had no more victims to devour, as persons who had surpassed Danton, Marat and Robespierre in doing mischief, and as having prostituted their daughters to the garrison to gain it over for Napoleon. An extract from this article, stamped with the crown and the arms of the Bourbons, was hawked about the streets, and the vendor was adorned with the medal of the police. Petition of the Protestant Refugees. To these reproaches it is proper to oppose the petition which the Protestant refugees in Paris presented to Louis XVIII in behalf of their brethren at Nîmes. "We lay at your feet, sire, our acute sufferings. In your name our fellow citizens are slaughtered and their property laid waste. Misled peasants, in pretended obedience to your orders, had assembled at the command of a commissioner appointed by your august nephew. Although ready to attack us, they were received with the assurances of peace. On the 15th of July, 1815, we learned your Majesty's entrance into Paris, and the white flag immediately waved on our edifices. The public tranquillity had not been disturbed when armed peasants introduced themselves. The garrison capitulated, but were assailed on their departure and almost totally massacred. Our National Guard was disarmed, the city filled with strangers, and the houses of the principal inhabitants, professing the reformed religion, were attacked and plundered. We subjoin the list. Terror has driven from our city the most respectable inhabitants. Your Majesty has been deceived if there has not been placed before you the picture of the horrors which make a desert of your good city of Nîmes. Arrests and proscriptions are continually taking place, and difference of religious opinions is the real and only cause. The calumniated Protestants are the defenders of the throne. Your nephew has beheld our children under his banners. Our fortunes have been placed in his hands. Attacked without reason, the Protestants have not, even by a just resistance, afforded their enemies the fatal pretext for calumny. Save us, sire! Extinguish the brand of civil war! A single act of your will would restore to political existence a city interesting for its population and its manufactures. Demand an account of their conduct from the chiefs who had brought our misfortunes upon us. We place before your eyes all the documents that have reached us. Fear paralyzes the hearts and stifles the complaints of our fellow citizens. Placed in a more secure situation, We venture to raise our voice in their behalf, etc., etc. Monstrous outrage upon females. At Nîmes, it is well known that the women wash their clothes either at the fountains or on the banks of streams. There is a large basin near the fountain where numbers of women may be seen every day, kneeling at the edge of the water and beating the clothes with heavy pieces of wood in the shape of battledores. This spot became the scene of the most shameful and indecent practices. The Catholic rabble turned the women's petticoats over their heads and so fastened them as to continue their exposure and their subjection to a newly invented species of chastisement. For nails being placed in the wood of the battoirs in the form of fleur-de-lis, they beat them until the blood streamed from their bodies and their cries rent the air. Often was death demanded as a commutation of this ignominious punishment, but refused with a malignant joy. To carry their outrage to the highest possible degree, several who were in a state of pregnancy were assailed in this manner. The scandalous nature of these outrages prevented many of the sufferers from making them public, and especially from relating the most aggravating circumstances. "I have seen," says Monsieur Durin, "a Catholic advocate accompanying the assassins of the Faubourg Bourgade, arm a battoir with sharp nails in the form of fleur-de-lis. I have seen them raise the garments of females and apply with heavy blows to the bleeding body this battoir or battledore, to which they gave a name which my pen refuses to record. The cries of the sufferers, the streams of blood, the murmurs of indignation, which were suppressed by fear, nothing could move them. The surgeons who attended on those women who are dead can attest by the marks of their wounds the agonies which they must have endured, which, however horrible, is most strictly true." Nevertheless, during the progress of these horrors and obscenities, so disgraceful to France and the Catholic religion, the agents of government had a powerful force under their command, and by honestly employing it they might have restored tranquillity. Murder and robbery, however, continued, and were winked at by the Catholic magistrates, with very few exceptions. The administrative authorities, it is true, used words in their proclamations, etc., but never had recourse to actions to stop the enormities of the persecutors, who boldly declared that on the 24th, the anniversary of St. Bartholomew, they intended to make a general massacre. The members of the Reformed Church were filled with terror, and instead of taking part in the election of deputies, were occupied as well as they could in providing for their own personal safety. Outrages committed in the villages, etc. We now quit Nîmes to take a view of the conduct of the persecutors in the surrounding country. After the re-establishment of the royal government, the local authorities were distinguished for their zeal and forwardness in supporting their employers and, under pretense of rebellion, concealment of arms, non-payment of contributions, etc., troops, national guards and armed mobs were permitted to plunder, arrest and murder peaceable citizens, not merely with impunity, but with encouragement and approbation. At the village of Millau, near Nîmes, the inhabitants were frequently forced to pay large sums to avoid being pillaged. This, however, would not avail at Madame Toulon's. On Sunday, the 16th of July, her house and grounds were ravaged, the valuable furniture removed or destroyed, the hay and wood burned, and the corpse of a child buried in the garden taken up and dragged round a fire made by the populace. It was with great difficulty that Monsieur Toulon escaped with his life. Monsieur Picherol, another Protestant, had deposited some of his effects with a Catholic neighbour. This house was attacked, and though all the property of the latter was respected, that of his friend was seized and destroyed. At the same village, one of a party, doubting whether Monsieur Hermé, a tailor, was the man they wanted, asked, "Is he a Protestant?" This he acknowledged. "Good," said they, and he was instantly murdered. In the canton of Vauvert, where there was a consistory church, 80,000 francs were extorted. In the communes of Beauvoisin and Générac, similar excesses were committed by a handful of licentious men under the eye of the Catholic mayor and to the cries of Vive le Roi. Saint-Gilles was the scene of the most unblushing villainy. The Protestants, the most wealthy of the inhabitants, were disarmed whilst their houses were pillaged. The mayor was appealed to, but he laughed and walked away. This officer had at his disposal a National Guard of several hundred men, organized by his own orders. It would be wearisome to read the lists of the crimes that occurred during many months. At Clavison, the mayor prohibited the Protestants the practice of singing the psalms commonly used in the temple, that, as he said, the Catholics might not be offended or disturbed. At Sommières, about 10 miles from Nîmes, the Catholics made a splendid procession through the town, which continued until evening and was succeeded by the plunder of the Protestants. On the arrival of foreign troops at Sommières, the pretended search for arms was resumed. Those who did not possess muskets were even compelled to buy them on purpose to surrender them up, and soldiers were quartered on them at 6 francs per day until they produced the articles in demand. The Protestant church, which had been closed, was converted into barracks for the Austrians. After divine service had been suspended for 6 months at Nîmes, the church, called the Temple by the Protestants, was reopened and public worship performed on the morning of the 24th of December. On examining the belfry, it was discovered that some persons had carried off the clapper of the bell. As the hour of service approached, a number of men, women and children collected at the house of Monsieur Ribaud, the pastor, and threatened to prevent the worship. At the appointed time, when he proceeded towards the church, he was surrounded. The most savage shouts were raised against him. Some of the women seized him by the collar, but nothing could disturb his firmness or excite his impatience. He entered the house of prayer and ascended the pulpit. Stones were thrown in and fell among the worshippers. Still, the congregation remained calm and attentive, and the service was concluded amidst noise, threats, and outrage. On retiring, many would have been killed but for the chasseurs of the garrison, who honourably and zealously protected them. From the captain of these chasseurs, Monsieur Ribaud soon after received the following letter. January 2, 1816. I deeply lament the prejudices of the Catholics against the Protestants, who they pretend do not love the king. Continue to act as you have hitherto done, and time and your conduct will convince the Catholics to the contrary. Should any tumult occur similar to that of Saturday last, inform me. I preserve my reports of these acts, and if the agitators prove incorrigible and forget what they owe to the best of kings and the charter, I will do my duty and inform the government of their proceedings. Adieu, my dear sir. Assure the consistory of my esteem and of the sense I entertain of the moderation with which they have met the provocations of the evil disposed at Sommières. I have the honour to salute you with respect, Suval de Laine. Another letter to this worthy pastor from the Marquis de Montlord was received on the 6th of January to encourage him to unite with all good men who believe in God to obtain the punishment of the assassins, brigands and disturbers of public tranquillity, and to read the instructions he had received from the government to this effect publicly. Notwithstanding this, on the 20th of January 1816, when the service in commemoration of the death of Louis XVI was celebrated, a procession being formed, the National Guards fired at the white flag suspended from the windows of the Protestants and concluded the day by plundering their houses. In the commune of Angargues, matters were still worse, and in that of Fontaine, from the entry of the king in 1815, the Catholics broke all terms with the Protestants. By day they insulted them, and in the night broke open the doors or marked them with chalk to be plundered or burned. Saint Mamère was repeatedly visited by these robberies, and at Montmiral, as lately as the 16th of June 1816, the Protestants were attacked, beaten and imprisoned for daring to celebrate the return of a king who had sworn to preserve religious liberty and to maintain the charter. Further account of the proceedings of the Catholics at Nîmes. The excesses perpetrated in the country, it seems, did not by any means divert the attention of the persecutors from Nîmes. October 1815 commenced without any improvement in the principles or measures of the government, and this was followed by corresponding presumption on the part of the people. Several houses in the Quartier Saint-Charles were sacked, and their wrecks burnt in the streets amidst songs, dances, and shouts of Vive le Roi. The mayor appeared, but the merry multitude pretended not to know him, and when he ventured to remonstrate, they told him his presence was unnecessary and that he might retire. During the 16th of October, every preparation seemed to announce a night of carnage. Orders for assembling and signals for attack were circulated with regularity and confidence. Trestaillon reviewed his satellites and urged them on to the perpetration of crimes, holding with one of those wretches the following dialogue. Satellite, if all the Protestants without one exception are to be killed, I will cheerfully join, but as you have so often deceived me, unless they're all to go, I will not stir. Trestaillon, come along then, for this time not a single man shall escape. This horrid purpose would have been executed had it not been for General Lagarde, the commandant of the department. It was not until 10 o'clock at night that he perceived the danger. He now felt that not a moment could be lost. Crowds were advancing through the suburbs, and the streets were filling with ruffians, uttering the most horrid imprecations. The Général sounded at 11 o'clock, and added to the confusion that was now spreading through the city. A few troops rallied round the Count Lagarde, who was wrung with distress at the sight of the evil which had arrived at such a pitch. Of this, Monsieur Durand, a Catholic advocate, gave the following account. It was near midnight. My wife had just fallen asleep. I was writing by her side when we were disturbed by a distant noise. Drums seemed crossing the town in every direction. What could all this mean? To quiet her alarm, I said it probably announced the arrival or departure of some troops of the garrison. But firing and shouts were immediately audible, and on opening my window I distinguished horrible imprecations mingled with cries of Vive le Roi. I roused an officer who lodged in the house, and Monsieur Chancel, director of the public works. We went out together and gained the boulevard. The moon shone bright, and almost every object was nearly as distinct as day. A furious crowd was pressing on, vowing extermination, and the greater part half-naked, armed with knives, muskets, sticks, and sabres. In answer to my inquiries, I was told the massacre was general, that many had been already killed in the suburbs. Monsieur Chancel retired to put on his uniform as captain of the Pompiers, the officers retired to the barracks, and, anxious for my wife, I returned home. By the noise, I was convinced that persons followed. I crept along in the shadow of the wall, opened my door, entered, and closed it, leaving a small aperture through which I could watch the movements of the party, whose arms shone in the moonlight. In a few moments some armed men appeared, conducting a prisoner to the very spot where I was concealed. They stopped. I shut my door gently, and mounted on an alder tree planted against the garden wall. What a scene! A man on his knees, imploring mercy from wretches who mocked his agony and loaded him with abuse. In the name of my wife and children, he said, spare me. What have I done? Why would you murder me for nothing? I was on the point of crying out and menacing the murderers with vengeance. I had not long to deliberate. The discharge of several fusils terminated my suspense. The unhappy supplicant, struck in the loins and the head, fell, to rise no more. The backs of the assassins were towards the trees. They retired immediately, reloading their pieces. I descended and approached the dying man, uttering some deep and dismal groans. Some National Guards arrived at the moment, and I again retired and shut the door. I see, said one, a dead man. He sings still, said another. It will be better, said a third, to finish him and put him out of his misery. Five or six muskets were fired instantly, and the groans ceased. On the following day, crowds came to inspect and insult the deceased. A day after a massacre was always observed as a sort of fete, and every occupation was left to go and gaze upon the victims. This was Louis Lichard, the father of four children, and 4 years after the event, Monsieur Durand verified this account by his oath upon the trial of one of the murderers. Attack upon the Protestant churches. Sometime before the death of General Lagarde, the Duc d'Angoulême had visited Nîmes and other cities in the south, and at the former place honoured the members of the Protestant consistory with an interview, promising them protection and encouraging them to reopen their temple, so long shut up. They have two churches at Nîmes, and it was agreed that the small one should be preferred on this occasion, and that the ringing of the bell should be omitted. General Lagarde declared that he would answer with his head for the safety of his congregation. The Protestants privately informed each other that worship was once more to be celebrated at 10 o'clock, and they began to assemble silently and cautiously. It was agreed that Monsieur Jouira Chasseur should perform the service, though such was his conviction of danger that he entreated his wife and some of his flock to remain with their families. The temple, being opened only as a matter of form and in compliance with the orders of the Duc d'Angoulême, this pastor wished to be the only victim. On his way to the place, he passed numerous groups who regarded him with ferocious looks. "This is the time," said some, "to give them the last blow." "Yes," added others, "and neither women nor children must be spared." One wretch, raising his voice above the rest, exclaimed, "Oh, I will go and get my musket and 10 for my share." Through these ominous sounds, Monsieur Jouirard pursued his course, but when he gained the temple, the sextons had not the courage to open the door, and he was obliged to do it himself. As the worshippers arrived, they found strange persons in possession of the adjacent streets and upon the steps of the church, vowing their worship should not be performed and crying, "Down with the Protestants! Kill them! Kill them!" At 10 o'clock, the church being nearly filled, Monsieur Chasseur commenced the prayers. A calm that succeeded was of short duration. On a sudden, the minister was interrupted by a violent noise, and a number of persons entered, uttering the most dreadful cries mingled with "Vive le roi!" But the gendarmes succeeded in excluding these fanatics and closing the doors. The noise and tumult without now redoubled, and the blows of the populace trying to break open the doors caused the house to resound with shrieks and groans. The voice of the pastors, who endeavoured to console their flock, was inaudible. They attempted in vain to sing the 42nd psalm. 3/4 of an hour rolled heavily away. "I place myself," said Madame Jouirard, "at the bottom of the pulpit with my daughter in my arms. My husband at length joined and sustained me. I remembered that it was the anniversary of my marriage. After 6 years of happiness," I said, "I'm about to die with my husband and my daughter. We shall be slain at the altar of our God, the victims of a sacred duty, and heaven will open to receive us and our unhappy brethren." I blessed the Redeemer, and without cursing our murderers, I awaited their approach. Monsieur Olivet, son of a pastor, an officer in the royal troops of the line, attempted to leave the church, but the friendly sentinels at the door advised him to remain besieged with the rest. The National Guards refused to act, and the fanatical crowd took every advantage of the absence of General Lagarde and of their increasing numbers. At length, the sound of martial music was heard, and voices from without called to the besieged, "Open! Open and save yourselves!" Their first impression was a fear of treachery, but they were soon assured that a detachment returning from Mass was drawn up in front of the church to favour the retreat of the Protestants. The door was opened, and many of them escaped among the ranks of the soldiers who had driven the mob before them. But this street, as well as others through which the fugitives had to pass, was soon filled again. The venerable pastor Olivier Desmond, between 70 and 80 years of age, was surrounded by murderers. They put their fists in his face and cried, "Kill the chief of brigands!" He was preserved by the firmness of some officers, among whom was his own son. They made a bulwark round him with their bodies, and amidst their naked sabres conducted him to his house. Monsieur Jouirard, who had assisted at divine service, with his wife at his side and his child in his arms, was pursued and assailed with stones. His mother received a blow on the head, and her life was sometime in danger. One woman was shamefully whipped, and several wounded and dragged along the streets. The number of Protestants more or less ill-treated on this occasion amounted to between 70 and 80. Murder of General Lagarde. At length a check was put to these excesses by the report of the murder of Count Lagarde, who, receiving an account of this tumult, mounted his horse and entered one of the streets to disperse a crowd. A villain seized his bridle, another presented the muzzle of a pistol close to his body, and exclaimed, "Wretch, you make me retire!" He immediately fired. The murderer was Louis Boissin, a sergeant in the National Guard. But though known to everyone, no person endeavoured to arrest him, and he effected his escape. As soon as the general found himself wounded, he gave orders to the gendarmerie to protect the Protestants, and set off on a gallop to his hotel, but fainted immediately on his arrival. On recovering, he prevented the surgeon from searching his wound until he'd written a letter to the government, that in case of his death it might be known from what quarter the blow came, and that none might dare to accuse the Protestants of the crime. The probable death of this general produced a small degree of relaxation on the part of their enemies, and some calm. But the mass of the people had been indulged in licentiousness too long to be restrained, even by the murder of the representative of their king. In the evening they again repaired to the temple, and with hatchets broke open the door. The dismal noise of their blows carried terror into the bosom of the Protestant families sitting in their houses in tears. The contents of the poor box and the clothes prepared for distribution were stolen, the minister's robes rent in pieces, the books torn up or carried away, the closets were ransacked, but the rooms which contained the archives of the church and the synods were providentially secured, and had it not been for the numerous patrols on foot, the whole would have become the prey of the flames and the edifice itself a heap of ruins. In the meanwhile, the fanatics openly ascribed the murder of the general to his own self-devotion, and said that it was the will of God. 3,000 francs were offered for the apprehension of Boissin, but it was well known that the Protestants dared not arrest him, and that the fanatics would not. During these transactions, the system of forced conversions to Catholicism was making regular and fearful progress. Interference of the British government. To the credit of England, the report of these cruel persecutions carried on against our Protestant brethren in France produced such a sensation on the part of the government as determined them to interfere, and now the persecutors of the Protestants made this spontaneous act of humanity and religion the pretext for charging the sufferers with a treasonable correspondence with England. But in this state of their proceedings, to their great dismay, a letter appeared, sent some time before to England by the Duke of Wellington, stating that much information existed on the events of the South. The ministers of the three denominations in London, anxious not to be misled, requested one of their brethren to visit the scenes of persecution and examine with impartiality the nature and extent of the evils they were desirous to relieve. Reverend Clement Perrault undertook this difficult task and fulfilled their wishes with a zeal, prudence and devotedness, above all, praise. His return furnished abundant and incontestable proof of a shameful persecution, materials for an appeal to the British Parliament, and a printed report which was circulated through the continent and which first conveyed correct information to the inhabitants of France.